The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of Spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Mixtape Memories. I'm Matt Hart Spade.
And I'm Jenners.
And we have a very special guest today, Billy Jones, who you may know from the band Other Passengers. You may know as the talent buyer for Shanae and Pianos. You may know from Babies. He has done many, many things through the years here in New York, and we're so excited to chat with you. So how you doing, Billy?
I'm doing well. Yes, I'm alive and kicking. Yeah.
Aren't we all? Yeah.
Yes.
Hanging on.
Definitely kicking, yeah.
So what have you been doing over the last year with the pandemic? I mean, obviously, I know Baby TV is happening. How have you kind of transitioned from live shows to no live shows and kind of, you know, what's on your horizon right now?
Well, yeah, I mean, personally, as soon as it happened in March of last year, it was kind of quick. We just sort of shut down, and I actually was in Los Angeles kind of beginning to really see through a project there. There's, you know, we've been working on a Babies Los Angeles for the past, I guess, 3 or 4 years, and construction had started and there was a lot of progress being made. And so I was in LA kind of doing that when all of this sort of happened and shut down. So my focus was really on that project after I had just kind of gotten through another project here in the city, this club called The Dance, that another long-winded trying project that opened up in October of 19 and then shuttered actually Valentine's Day 2020, so literally right before Corona. So yeah, so it was sort of shocking, and everything sort of, you know, with The Dance stopping and, you know, Babies LA freezing, and then, you know, Babies Brooklyn stopping, it was kind of like a moment of like, what, you know, what is next and what should we do? I think at the time we, you know, we were trying to play it by ear, as everyone was, and the streaming thing hadn't really started yet, but it was pretty much the obvious next step is to start doing shows. So we started the Baby TV thing. And yeah, and I think that's been really great for the community. It's been, you know, to keep morale going and keep people active and giving people a platform to, you know, to continue on. But I think there's a lot of exhaustion there for everyone. And, you know, I mean, not just for streaming, but just in general. So I think we're just kind of, we're still in that wait and see mode. And, you know, as this is being taped, things are kind of looking up a little bit, you know, even over the past week, you can kind of feel the energy picking up around people getting excited about programming outdoor spaces, doing some special things, you know, actually, you know, maybe on the roof at Babies, maybe around the corner, like a street block party or something, or these open culture spaces that the city has sort of set aside for venues to produce concerts this summer. So I think a lot of that is going to start ramping up. Babies never really opened up partially, even though we are kind of a restaurant and a bar, just kind of made the decision that to bring everyone back and to get all that energy together when like the venue and the music and the community is sort of our main purpose, that I kind of wanted to wait until we can have like a special grand reopening, you know, with like streamers and wiki wacky men and like balloons and a sign that says like under same management or something. And, you know, and just like, you know, do a bunch of special shows, just, you know, to celebrate our 7th birthday or something, you know, it's just, and have it feel like a brand new thing again and a new party. And rather than have this sort of potential of like, oh, there's a variant coming, maybe there's going to be another, you know, pullback. So, you know, luckily we've had some help with some government loans, and there is this grant that was passed on the last stimulus bill called the
Save Our Stages.
That's right. Yeah, Save Our Stages. And the shuttered, I think it's like there's like a specific name of it within the bill. But yeah, we're, I think everyone's sort of standing by waiting for, you know, the gates to open on applying for that grant. So it's almost like refresh, refresh, refresh on the SBA website. But I'm sure, you know, hopefully that will come soon. And a lot of these venues can sort of start planning for the future. It's been a weird year. It's just been kind of waiting and seeing, and a lot of self-reflection, and some pivoting, some personal pivoting, and starting other projects that, you know, I've just never had time to do, or things I've wanted to do. And it's the only thing possible right now. So.
Mm-hmm. Like what kind of projects have you been?
If you can share,
I guess I can share. I get it's sort of in the process of happening soon, but I actually haven't shared this with anyone publicly, but I'm going to open up a record store in Greenpoint.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm discussing lease terms. It's not signed, but it's looking very close. It's literally on my block. It was weird. I was sort of exhausted with music at the end of, like, prior to Corona, and I was listening to more podcasts and, you know, books on tapes and stuff, because it was just sort of like, you know, I don't know, it's like when I worked at Starbucks when I was in high school. It was like you get sick of the coffee really fast. I don't know if that's a good comparison, but it's like I just making music my job forever, and kind of listening to the new stuff and understanding, and then you kind of need a break. And
That's fair.
Yeah, I've been reinvigorated there, but I just, you know, I've always had a really passionate love for jazz and sort of music that has come out of that. And so during this break, I've had a lot of time to kind of reengage with that passion, you know, watching hours of YouTube videos, like the vinyl community, and probably buying too many records online. Yeah, just learning a lot and listening all day. So I think a lot of people are at home listening more. It's almost like, you know, putting a record on is the closest thing to a live concert or an event that I can sort of attend right now. And so it's really exciting for me. It's like a dream of mine to do this. Yeah, super excited.
I love
that. Congrats.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Yeah.
What kind of stuff are you going to be selling? Is it going to be jazz stuff, or is it going to be?
Yeah, no, it's going to be mainly jazz, but it's sort of like a, you know, I sort of want it to be an inviting environment for people that are either interested in the music or do know a lot. It's like, I feel like a lot of record stores, you walk in and it's like you're walking on eggshells, or it's this kind of, I don't know. It's just like, I've always been, my job has always been to turn people onto the things I love and on a different level, and so this is now my opportunity. From all the time and research I've done, I really want to share with people some of that stuff, and I want this space to kind of be sort of 60-40 music and records to, like, hanging out and sort of like a center, a community center, and potentially do talks and small little performances. It's a very small space, but, you know, and there'll be some sort of component in the street, sort of a cafe, sort of, you know, now that everyone in New York can have, if you have the right, you know, zoning, we can do sort of cafe style street coffee and maybe, you know, wine and beer down the line. So I kind of just, yeah, I want it to be a place to kind of come, like an open environment to buy music, and, you know, different approaches, like a section that's like, you know, cooking, like, what do I listen to when I'm cooking, or something like love making or something, you know. It's like, so it'll be a focus on just sort of jazz and, you know, rare groove music and funk and soul and psychedelic music, but I think just sort of framing it in the jazz sense, because that will be the majority of it, will kind of, you know, it's a different sort of brand or niche kind of thing to come check out.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I feel like you've really cultivated a career as a curator, so it makes sense to kind of branch out and, you know, open a record store. That makes total sense to me.
Yeah, and it's like I find these sort of records with terrible covers from like 1976 that, you know, I find like four or five amazing songs on it, and I know it's cheap, and I want to like tell people about it and be like, you have to just take, it's $5, you have to take this home, like this record's incredible, you know. And it's like that feeling of them being like, okay, and like, and then them getting the same joy that I've gotten during this period is like super exciting. So I've been, you know, a DJ. I have a show on Lot Radio, little plug there, called Long Haired Jazz, that I've been doing. That's been really exciting too, and as like another sort of outlet of this sort of new direction. And I'd love to bring a lot of that back to Babies All Right too when we open, and sort of because there is a young community of, you know, jazz musicians in New York and Chicago and the UK and LA, and it's like, you know, allowing, creating, bringing, having a space for a lot of those people to sort of present things in like a rock venue or like a sort of a venue like Babies, where you know, maybe it would usually be somewhere else, like a New Blue or BB King's or something, you know, but trying to promote and support that music, the current wave of that stuff that's going on, and not just me selling records from, you know, the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to the Save Our Stages, the passage of that bill. I noticed that Schumer, when he gave his press conference, was in front of Babies, and I just thought that was so cool. Did that come about randomly?
Yeah, actually, I'd love to say that it was like sort of randomly. I'd love to say that we're close friends, and he, you know, he texted me, and I was like, Charles, you know, I'm busy. Anyway, so yeah, I was actually contacted by Jen Lyon, a colleague and longtime friend of mine, and a local promoter, and also in Detroit, has a company called Mean Red, and she's been doing a lot of great work with Neva. And she was contacted by Schumer's office, and apparently they requested Babies. I don't know if it had sort of, they'd seen it, or if, I'm assuming maybe that someone in Schumer's office had maybe kind of, you know, been to like Drake night or something at Babies. I don't know, but maybe it just sort of, you know, it's, maybe it was just known, and they're like, yeah, why don't you try this place? It's sort of, you know, there's like an awning, and it's in the middle of the heart of Williams, you know. So yeah, I got the call from Jen, and it was like kind of fast. It was like, hey, you know, can we do this press conference with, you know, Chuck Schumer? And I was like, sure. And she was like, can you introduce him? And I was like, okay. I was like, sure. I'm like, I'm kind of in bed isolating in a dark cloud for the past 2 days, but I'll get up. I'll put clothes on. So I did it, and it was really wild. I was, you know, there's a photo of me, James Murphy, Chuck Schumer, all like with like masks on. Chuck Schumer has his fist in the air, and it says like, all right. And I was like, you know, if someone had showed me this image, like when I first met you guys, and said, try and explain to me what this means, I would be like, what the, like, it was so surreal, you know, cause like I losing my edge was like, you know what, that was like one of the first, that was like the beginning of this whole thing for us probably, mm-hmm. you know? And so here I am actually losing my edge years later in front of Babies with, you know, Chuck Schumer and James Murphy. So yeah, that was really wild. It was funny because he took like a day or two to kind of do press on his support of Neva being, or Save Our Stages being a part of that act. And he went on the James Corden show, and actually mentioned, you know, there's great venues like Babies All Right. You know, it's like, because I think it's just like one venue that he knew, and he was there. So we got a little extra plug there on James Corden. So that was funny too.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. So I'm still, you know, since I gave him a favor, I'm kind of holding on to that, you know, my back. But I mean, he's going to have to come up for me big one day. but yeah.
That's so funny. Well, I'm so glad that you got some extra press, because like I feel like everything you've done over there and just in your career as like a talent buyer and curator really deserves that kind of attention.
I appreciate that. Yeah, it's been quite a trip. It's, you know, I think I'm, you know, listening to some of the music from when I first moved here, which I'm sure we'll get to, but or after. But it's I think I'm coming on 20 years in New York, and a majority of that after, you know, playing for a few years. But even when I was playing, I was sort of booking shows or curating or, you know, finding the best bands in town to sort of, you know, get to play with me to sort of make my band seem like we were as good as they were. So I was always good at kind of like finding the best bands in town, or at least much better at that than maybe being one. But yeah, it's weird how much time goes by, how much time has gone by. And I've just seen so many things kind of come and go, and yeah, it's fascinating. It's been a fascinating ride.
When you came to New York 20 years ago, first off, where did you come from? And also, did you come to New York with a specific mission in mind?
Oh yeah. Well, I had graduated college in 2001, and then I went home for the summer and got a job in like my field, which is like video editing. And I was basically a receptionist at this post-production facility, but it was like at least, you know, close to that, what I had studied. But I'd always known that I wanted to play music, and I had a bunch of high school friends that we would play music in the summer, recording and stuff. So I was like secretly plotting, and I was reading this, oddly, I was reading this book called Bong Water at the time, and it was set in Portland, Oregon. It actually later became sort of a really low rate B film, sort of indie film. I think Jack Black was actually in it early, but nonetheless, I was reading this book, and then 9/11 happened. And it was just like everything. I mean, we all went through it, but it was just sort of like, forget anything that I thought I was going to do that was like by the books. I'm going to do what I want, because like the world's ending and, you know, fuck this, you know? So I was like, I kind of convinced all my friends to sort of pick up. And a month later, we were in like a budget van with all of our stuff, no jobs, no apartment, driving across country to Portland, because I was like, oh, it sounded cool in this book, and Steve Malkmus might be around. We can go find Malkmus, you know. And it was like, so that was like, that's what we did. And I was in Portland for about 10 months and sort of cut my teeth on playing music. And we would play at this place called Medicine Hat Gallery every week, and that actually was the first name of the first band. Well, Other Passengers was called Medicine Hat first, but so yeah, we learned how to do what we were eventually going to do. And then we got evicted from our house in Portland due to noise complaints, which is, you know, the noise complaints have sort of followed me through my career up until
I bet
babies, where it's still somewhat of a problem. Even in my apartment, I have like a dB level on how loud I can play records. But yeah, so it kind of fell apart in Portland, but at the time Williamsburg was, it was becoming quite the thing. And even when I graduated, it was like, oh, everyone's moving to Williamsburg. It's so over, you know, it's like, and this is like, you know, it had barely even, you know, scratched the surface. So I kind of gave in and said, okay, you know, let's move to New York. And that's when, you know, the Walkman was the EP came out, and then right before Interpol's record and the Liars came. So there was this, now there was this post 9/11 strokes kind of energy. And it was like New York, New York, New York. And I was like, and I had just read, I was at a Barnes and Noble in Richmond, Virginia, where I used to get like a stack of magazines, you know, and just like flip through and dream about like playing music and being in the city. And there was this one article in a Fader that sort of profiled 10 small venues around New York, and Pianos was one of them, and Counter Commons was the booker. And I remember seeing this and being like, I've got to get there. I've got to go meet that guy. Like, I've got to go now, you know? So I used the money that I had gotten from totaling my car in Portland and the few dollars I saved up working. And I just kind of came to New York in October of 2002 and just sort of dove in, like ready to go and ready to make music and, you know, get famous, get indie famous as soon as possible.
Well, I feel like that's how I met you, was when you were in Other Passengers, and like I was definitely yes. very into that band and like that dark kind of you know, psychedelic kind of rock that you were making, and I think like you know, that was when it was like kind of easy to kind of make friends with bands and like just create like this community, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And it was because it was bands, you know, it was people playing shows. There wasn't a lot of sort of laptop musicians at the time. People had to get practice spaces, had to get together. You know, the model of what was making it at the time was, you know, rock bands or, you know, post-Brit pop bands or, you know, it was about sort of indie rock, really. It was just like indie rock and indie pop at the time. And so those things were like what people wanted to do and had to do. And you had to get together and you had to play shows. And there were so many venues in the city and they were popping up all the time. But you know, you would play and you'd find your friends. And then there was like 6 blogs and everyone knew about them. And it was blog 1.0. And you just wanted to get one of them to your show and then, you know, post about you. And then it was just such a weird time. I remember the first time, and I never knew how to pronounce, and I still don't, even though I worked with Jasper for so many years, but Jenik, or is it Jenny? Jenik, yeah, Jenik.com.
Jenik, yeah.
And I remember getting posted on that the first time with his like outrageous descriptions, but having someone from Columbia Records reach out about seeing the band, and we had played like 3 shows and we were just like, you know, it was on the you know, the legs of like a EP we had kind of made in our bedroom, and we're just starting to play it out live. And you know, them coming to see us at Mercury Lounge and probably leaving 35 seconds into the set. But yeah, it was a time when there was those were the only things that people were kind of looking at, you know, that and, you know, Pitchfork early days. But so yeah, it was a really, really interesting and different time than what it is now. New York was like it was like a real community of like, you know, live bands playing.
When did the pianos gig kind of come into fruition? Yeah, can you talk about that role?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I've been playing music a lot, and like I said, booking a lot of shows and stuff. And I had, you know, I played Shanae a lot, and Bill Bronson, who was the talent buyer there, he had also, you know, he had also come up playing in bands. He was in Angels of Light at the time when I met him, which was Michael Giroir from Swans' band. So I had a lot of respect and admired him. And he was kind of like, he had to get his attention. It was funny, he was a Bill too. And then his assistant was Bill Bertel, who was in a band called The Blondes, which was this kind of mm-hmm. rock mm-hmm. band that was, you know, they would style their hair and wear suits and kind of hokey at the time, but like Bill was really an amazing guy. And you know, he really loved, you know, jazz and classical. And I remember I insisted that after one of our Shanae shows that the sound man put on Thelonious Monk's music, and that kind of blew Bill's mind, Bertel. And so we kind of became close, and unfortunately Bill, the assistant, had some sort of stomach thing occur where he lost his voice and couldn't sing anymore. So he had to sort of retreat from New York and move back to North Carolina, where he's from. And he asked me, he's like, hey, do you want to do this? And I was like, sure. Like I'm done working at cafes, or I had so many weird odd jobs. I was a substitute teacher. I worked at Oxygen Network. I worked at, you know, like a vegan restaurant in Union Square called Other Foods. Like, so I was just sort of hustling to do whatever I could to, you know, to get to the next week and just play music whenever I could. And so this just seemed like a really good opportunity. So I jumped at it. Actually, Bill ended up going to North Carolina and refocusing his life on classical music that he had studied at Vanderbilt, and then starting his own classical label called New Amsterdam with his friend Judd Greenstein, who I later came back into contact with in a completely different context. So we've remained in touch, but it's pretty incredible. That was my start. And, you know, I just kind of worked at Chennai and created nights and booked and sort of got active in the community. And then Chennai kind of, you know, it was a tough scene. It was, you know, we didn't, you know, it was a big space on Attorney and Stanton Street. A lot of stuff happened, but it was always kind of struggling because we never really got a full liquor license. So it was really hard to get by. So with those challenges, it sort of parted ways. And I had always been close with Jasper at Pianos, who had written about the band. And yeah, I just texted him and asked him if he needed help. And he said, yeah, come on over. And that was sort of the beginning of my experience with Pianos. And yeah, that was quite a wild experience too. So
you had that role for many, many years, no?
I did. I think like five or six years, mm-hmm. I think, you know. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah, I was there kind of, it was interesting because it was a time when blogs were becoming a little bit more and more blogs were popping up, and CMJ, you know, was kind of coming really blog influenced. And I had made it, I think I was not one of the, I was one of the first to sort of invite people, bloggers, to be like, hey, you should do a party for CMJ. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, with Brooklyn Vegan doing his first parties at Pianos and stuff like that. So that was kind of how that sort of model of those day parties with blogs and sort of started by doing those at Pianos. And Pianos, really more than anything, aside from some famous residencies and things like that, became sort of the center of CMJ when that festival was sort of at its peak, or at least its second peak, you know, during the its aughts peak. But yeah, that was really fun when the Lower East Side was completely activated with, you know, all these venues, and it made for the festival to be like really easy and accessible to see a lot of stuff in a short amount of time.
At what point were you like piecing out of the bands, like being in a band and creating music?
Other Passengers had we signed a record deal, I think it was in like 2010 or something. I don't even know. It's all very blurry. I think it was 9 or 10. And it was a UK label, kind of a small label. They had like the Silent League in the UK. But yeah, so they were kind of a smaller label. But, you know, when it was time to go over there, we had to, you know, we were going to tour and go to the UK. The band kind of imploded. So we actually never toured in support of our record that came out there. And the band kind of broke up, and I tried doing solo things and tried to get it together. And then I eventually found another production partner, and we started, you know, a project called New Moods, which was always really hard to say. Mm-hmm. People always thought I was saying New Moons, but yeah, we started New Moods, and that was like my last, like, all right, let's do it. And it was a little bit more poppy. It was kind of like Joy Division to New Order as Other Passengers to New Moods. So it was a little bit more beat oriented and electronic, and we were making a record and things were going pretty well, except, you know, my partner sort of had some personal issues and some sickness kind of stuff. And I saw that it went as far as it could after trying. We played like 10 shows at South by Southwest, and it was just kind of like, okay, this, and that was right about the time when Babies was starting to become sort of a concept and a thing. And I was kind of like, okay, I think I need to focus on this one thing that's kind of been working for me for a long time, mm-hmm. and sort of let go of this thing that's cost me so much anguish and pain. and it was really nice. It was like, I can have a peaceful life, and this is really, I'm still really close to the music, and I love working with artists, and I love being around artists. So, you know, I think I've carried on as close to music as I've could without actually producing some myself.
Yeah, I mean, that's still like a creative role, that, you know, curating and kind of you know,
supporting, and facilitating access to things that some artists just don't care about or don't know. It was like, I was like working more and more in the industry, and I was still in a band, and I sort of had this Jekyll and Hyde where it was like, I almost didn't want people to know I worked in the industry, because they'd be like, oh, the only reason he figured that out is because he's, you know, So I'd kind of like hide, you know, that I worked. And it's, I think it's really hard to work in the industry and play in the industry because you really need to sort of focus on the art alone and develop that. So I think I kind of became a bridge of someone who really understands. And there's a lot of people in music, but a lot of people in music have never really tried to get as far as they could playing it. And then, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of A&R guys in LA that, you know, you hear about that were in bands and stuff, but, you know, in the music industry as a whole, it's, I kind of became sort of an ambassador to the artist and, like, you know, softening the blow into this sort of harsh music business that, you know, is around us.
I was wondering if we could take it all the way back and if you could kind of tell us what you were listening to as a kid, as a teenager, in your early 20s, kind of before the move to New York, and what kind of inspired the band and the bands, plural,
yeah,
and so on.
Oh, man, yeah. Where should I start? I mean, I was thinking about, I remember the first two things. I had two older sisters, and they weren't, like, the biggest music heads. My parents didn't have a lot of records. I remember my parents had a copy of Double Fantasy, which I think came out, you know, the year I was born. That was like the coolest record they had in their stack from what I looked at in high school. But my sisters, yeah, I remember hearing like Violent Femmes' second record with Blister in the Sun on it, and like Frank Zappa's Valley Girl and Beastie Boys' License to Ill. And like, so some of that music was like catching my attention at a very young age that my sisters were playing. So I was around that, but my own personal discovery, you know, I think music really clicked for me and really started to happen around the time of, like, you know, seventh grade, with like when 10, I think 10 was a big influence. I don't think I've ever vocalized that to myself, but I think Pearl Jam's 10 was like a really huge influence, because it sort of hit me like emotionally, and it was like powerful, and like, you know, Smells Like Teen Spirit had sort of come out, and that was a big thing. And that's sort of, you know, being in seventh grade and having that music, you know, watching 120 Minutes and Nirvana on TV, and like, so just, you know, and then it was all of that. It was like that whole period of like Beck and Mellow Gold and, you know, all of that, the grunge stuff that was happening on television, Woodstock, the, you know, 95 and stuff at 15. And then, so all of that stuff. And then, you know, and then hearing like the pop punk and then ska and then all of this and that and this, and then it all sort of led up until, you know, I think like, you know, high school, when it kind of got into like listening to Radiohead, was a, like when the Bends came out, I think that was like the, probably the, that's when it started to be like, I want to do this. Like, this music is like my, I'd fallen in love for the first time. I actually had my heart broken the first time, like listening to the Bends on a flight to LA, like with a heartbroken, you know, and just feeling it, you know, in my feelings, like so hard, and, you know, making mixtapes for, you know, that same girl with like Tori Amos and The Cure and like, you know, like Mazzy Star, like all this kind of music that you would like sit in bed in the dark and sort of contemplate everything. So I was really attracted to a lot of that music, you know, and Britpop, having access to like Much Music, which was like a Canadian music television show. So I used to always love watching Much Music and finding artists that no one else in America kind of knew about. And so it was always like a thing that became this thing of like discovery, or even early. I remember finding this artist, Hayden, who I was absolutely in love with, who was kind of like a post Beck kind of Canadian, really. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but I remember. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember like in 10th grade, I was from Long Island, sneaking into Mercury, like coming to the city and sneaking into Mercury Lounge, and just thinking it was like I died and gone to heaven, like knowing every word. And there was like 40 people in the audience, and here Hayden was like this star to me and my friends. And I remember going up to asking him after the show if like he listened to Radiohead, and I was always dying to know what he thought of Radiohead and stuff. And but it was weird coming back to Mercury Lounge years later. And but yeah, I mean, I think music in high school for me was just, it became an obsession. And then at the end, you know, more and more started listening to things from the past. But yeah, I'd say I'd say Radiohead was the biggest influence from the Benz to OK Computer, and then Kid A were just kind of, me and my friends were just obsessed with that, and you know, Pavement and Talking Heads, and yeah, all of that. I remember going to see the Tibetan Freedom concert, and it was, that was just kind of the height of all the, all of that stuff, you know. It was like Pavement, Bjork, the Beastie Boys. Yeah, it was like, that was the height of all of that stuff for me. And Radiohead actually played too, like as a duo, but yeah.
Yeah, we've talked about Tibetan Freedom concert a couple times on the podcast.
Yeah, I think it's a, like a kind of a mark for all of, yeah, if you got to go.
Yeah.
Were you like more of a maker of mixtapes, or did you receive mixtapes a lot?
I think both, but yeah, I definitely, with my first high school love, we had like, we communicated our feelings through mixtapes. I actually stumbled on a few of them, like going through storage in Richmond during, you know, COVID. And it's just crazy. Like you remember like the segues, you remember, I didn't listen to them because I even had trouble like listening to the stuff that we're going to talk about. I just, for me, like listening to music from the past, it's like, it's kind of like looking at old pictures, which I'm not really good at doing either. And it's like listening to old songs is, it's even more vivid than the pictures are, because it's like the feelings, the smells and everything sort of come rushing back. But yeah, if I put on some of those tapes now, I would probably remember the next song that was coming next. And, you know, some weird like Alice in Chains ballad from Jar of Flies into like, you know, like that acoustic song on Led Zeppelin where it's like Brawny Yur into like, you know, Winter by Tori Amos. And, you know, it's like all of these kind of really heavy kind of things, you know, Pictures of You into like Nine Inch Nails, like Something I Can Never Have, you know, like, so those were like, that was the kind of area of music that we were kind of playing. Those were our songs, if you will. Shout out Kristen if you somehow are listening to this.
If you somehow stumble on this, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you saw my Instagram story. You clicked it. There you are.
Exactly.
No, but yeah, so that was like, and you know, I mean, all the music I think from like 15 to 23, like that's the stuff. I can't, you know, and there's like studies that have proven that, but it's like, that's where all of the, you know, tattoos on my soul from all those tapes and CDs and stuff, you know, remain to this day.
Yeah, totally. No, it sticks with you. I know you were talking about Radiohead, and I think it might be a nice way to segue into the first album that we're going to be covering for Repeat Skip, because this band actually opened for Radiohead back in the aughts. I think on a couple tours, actually. It's Clinic and their debut album, Internal Wrangler, from 2000. I love this album so much. I was so happy that you picked it. And yeah, my first introduction to Clinic, I remember reading, I don't even know where it was, but it was right around the time when Kid A came out. And there was an article that was like, if you're disappointed that Radiohead went in this direction, you should listen to these bands. And it listed Clinic. It listed Sigur Rós. I don't remember what else was on there. Maybe Doves or something. And I was like, Clinic, what is this band about? And then I Googled them and I was like, this whole, their look was just like, I'm into it already. And then I was listening and I was like, okay, now I need to pick up the CD. And I was immediately hooked with Internal Wrangler, just because it, for me, it was like, something about it was so random and experimental, but something about it was very poppy in a sense and kind of crazy and frenetic. And I don't know, I really enjoyed this record, and I have a lot more to say, but I want to hear what you thought of this record, Billy.
Yeah, I mean, I remember a lot of the, sort of those same feelings. I think that the record kind of came out, I think, overseas in 2000, and then really didn't come out in the US and a year later. So I remember there was like, you know, there was a lot of buzz, and I was reading, you know, Pitchfork since like 1998, and I had like a T1 connection at college, and I sort of stumbled on it And when it was probably just Ryan in his apartment, you know, posting every now and then. So I was kind of obsessed with that. You know, I think it was called pitchfork.com at the time, but, and then you went to it and there was like a Pitchfork and redirected to Pitchfork.
I remember
media.
The actual
yeah.
Pitchfork.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I would always like, and I would be like, you know, snobby about the reviews or like have my opinion and be like, you know, and it was like, so it was like what they were reviewing. And I just remember, I think it came out and it was just like hyped from the gate. And I was like, but like I heard it and Radiohead had like co-signed on it. And I think same with you, like I was really in that sort of Sigur Rós Radiohead kind of Clinic thing. Yeah, I just remember, I think it was even the Strokes had sort of started to happen in America because they had done that tour in the fall, maybe, or it was around the same time. So it kind of had that same sort of garage rock, cool, raspy, kind of poppy, but still a little bit loose kind of element, but with some of that esoteric British kind of conceptual side, the more art rock kind of Wire and Can thing that I was like super interested too. So it sort of spoke to me a bit more than the Stroke stuff, but I was, yeah. And it was just, it was beautiful. It was simple. And, you know, it kind of had, it sort of touched on a lot of familiar things. You could hear like Iggy Pops in there, Iggy Pops, you know, Iggy Pops in there.
He's Pops now. He's 70
yeah,
or so.
Yeah, he's definitely. And, you know, like, and just like, you know, there was just, and it was funny and the artwork was like so interesting because it was like a complete ripoff of this jazz record, which I also thought was interesting too, because the Strokes record, and I don't think people talk about it too much, but the second cover of that Strokes record is actually a complete ripoff of someone else's record too. I think a lesser known like rock band from the 80s or 90s or something. But so it sort of, that's a side note, but it was the Ornette Coleman record. And so I just thought it was, I just thought they were so cool. Like I just, and like the pace and the diversity and the range of tracks from like Distortions, which is still probably one of the most heartbreaking songs, the most beautiful songs I've ever heard in my life, to, you know, like Return of Evil Bill or, you know, I think every song on that record is perfect and they're all kind of short, but they're all complete thoughts. And by the time it ends, you're just like, and then you kind of like, you could just start it over again. And that's mm-hmm. always a good sign of a record where it almost feels like a mixtape, if you will. You know, it's like a record collector's mixtape or something, or, you know, but yeah, just, I really loved it. And for me, I remember I really fell into that love with that record around 9/11. And I remember walking around, I was in Richmond, Virginia. And I remember just kind of walking around the streets of Richmond downtown with that on headphones and just kind of like a ghost, and like walking into a church and sitting down and just like staring blankly, listening to Clint. Like I can still see that moment now. And that, and you know, that was another band that was kind of like, yeah, this is what I want to do. I want to make music with my friends and, you know, get close to this feeling as possible.
Yeah. Oh, I could see that. Yeah, for sure. Kind of vibing with the other passengers stuff.
Definitely.
And like, I also felt like that album was like a complete journey and like pretty perfect, I felt like, because there's just all sorts of sounds going on, but they all really work together, even though it can change from song to song. And you know, the energy, like the really like unique vocals in it. And
yeah, just... I really appreciated, I actually listened to it again today prior to this. And I, you know, a lot of people can hear a song and remember the lyrics right away, or all they hear is the lyrics. And for some reason, I could hear a song 1,000 times and be like in a car and like fake, like blah, like not knowing, like knowing the song by heart, but just not knowing what the lyrics are. It's just, I don't know if it's, you know, I'm left-handed or I'm just, something's wrong with me. But I, so like music that has, you know, no actual lyrical, like there's only a few songs on that record that have distinguishable words or lyrics. And mm-hmm. much like Sigur Rós and Hope Landic, you know, I really, and like Can is another good example where it's like, I don't understand it, but it's beautiful and I can feel it. And it sort of allows me to just sort of focus on the music better, or just feel the music as a whole better, which is kind of like jazz too, because there's no lyrics. So I think that once the lyrics come into play, it adds such a different element to, which is not bad because I love songs and I love great lyrics and there's a beauty to it, but there's a different sort of approach to listening to music that doesn't have that element, and it's kind of liberating in a way.
Yeah, and I think there's such an incredible live act with all the random vintage instruments and whatnot, and obviously they're all dressed alike. I think they've always been fascinating. First time I saw them was with Radio 4, remember them, at Pier 54 in the early aughts. And I remember just like freaking out that I finally got to see them, because at that point I'd been a fan for maybe 2-3 years. And then I've seen them, I would say, almost every single tour, like U.S. tour, when they come to New York. And when they came to Bell House, maybe in like 2010, I think they were touring the Bubblegum album. And at that point, I had written about the band X amount of times, and I would DM with Abe, I think is the singer's name. And I remember he invited me backstage to Bell House to like say hi to them, and they didn't have the masks on. And my jaw was on the ground because I wasn't ready for that. Because, like, you know, you just, when you think of Clinic, you think of the masks and how timely it is right now. But like, I don't know. It was like a trip for me.
It's like running into Daft Punk at like Whole Foods and on Sunset. But, you know, it's like, it's like, wow, what? No.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was, the reason I in part picked Clinic too, aside from the record, is it was the first show I saw in New York when I got here. And it was October 18th, 2002. It was at Warsaw with Animal Collective. I liked Animal Collective's record, Here Come the Indians, but I was really there to see Clinic. And I remember I got kicked out. I got thrown out. It was almost like that scene in like Fresh Prince of Bel-Air where like Jazzy Jeff gets like kicked out or whatever. It's like, I got kicked out the side door for moshing, because I was like, I probably had a few drinks, and I was so excited, and it was like, this was such a huge moment for me, and I couldn't, I just couldn't contain myself, because that music does have like a charging, like you just want to.
It almost makes you nervous in a sense.
Oh yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I ended up just not getting to see the rest of the show, but yeah, that was my first concert in New York. Yeah. And what a good one in retrospect, you know, Animal Collective going on to become the thing that, you know, they kind of were to New York and the world. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What would you say is like your favorite track from that album?
Just Distortions. Yeah.
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 Yeah. There's something so beautiful about that track. And like you said, something so pure that, I don't know. I mean, obviously it stands out on the record as maybe the anomaly, but it's just such a classic, like golden track, I think.
Yeah. It was originally called Abortions. And the label thought that was a little too heavy handed. So they changed the chorus to Distortions, because I think it comes about, there's actually a demo on YouTube for the Abortions version you can listen to, which I kind of learned this recently, like, you know, last year or 2 years ago or something, but it kind of makes sense because it's a very personal, you just kind of feel that you're just like out there with his feelings and at the end, and it kind of, you know, yeah, it has like a, kind of has like a, Oh Sweet Nothing or, there's another Velvet Underground ending song, or, you know, Dry the Rain or so. Or it just has this like coda that you just kind of feel on this release at the end of it. But yeah, that's definitely, that's the one I show people. I'm like, oh, you've never heard them? You have to hear this song. Like that'll be the one I play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, I think all three of us really love this release, so it's kind of tough. I mean, I probably would pick Evil Bill, Distortions, Second Foot Stomp. I mean, I even love the closer, Goodnight
Sweet
Georgie.
George,
I love
Sweet
this
George,
whole record.
Yeah.
There's just like, you know, I was kind of jotting down notes, re-listening to this record, and probably the only thing I would skip is like one of the short interludes, DJ Shangri-La.
Yeah.
Which was, I mean, unnecessary, but yeah. I didn't hate it.
Yeah, and even the opening is just so weird. It's like, what, it's like 50 seconds and it has this, like, these waves crash, but it, like, sets up the next song so perfectly that it's like, yeah, it's really smart.
Reading that the singer but the band as a whole were kind of like superstitious, and when it originally came out they didn't want to have like a 13th track, so it was just like 4 seconds of silence. And I just thought that was like really interesting, because like
that's really me. I never knew that. Yeah. No.
Funny.
Yeah.
But yeah, I found it hard to actually pick like a track that I would skip, just because I felt like the album was just so good, and but I don't know. I think I just like ended up like, if I had to choose one, Goodnight Georgie, but I don't know. I wouldn't skip it though in actual life.
Yeah, it's pretty perfect. In actual life. But I feel like they got so much more attention with the following release, with Walking With Thee, when they actually had like an MTV single and they got to play, I think they played Letterman or one of the late night shows. So they had, I think that was kind of their peak fame, maybe.
They were nominated for a Grammy for that record.
Mm-hmm.
Which is so weird in retrospect. Yeah. For the best alternative album. But I it's weird that they sort of came out with that kind of felt like a kind of like, you know, continuation of kind of like the, what was the second Strokes record? Was it a Room on Fire, where it was like kind of like not as good or not as, but like a continuation of some of those thoughts. And then I feel like Clinic kind of just unfortunately never really made something, you know, they made their music and they just kind of kept making it for better or for worse. But it was like, you know, hearing that first record and having not heard them before had such an impact. But, you know, I kind of wish they had made, I guess my skip here would be all the records after it.
Yeah, so. I do feel like nothing was really as exciting as Internal Wrangler for me, but I still love them, but that was definitely my favorite.
Yeah, it was a moment in time, and it was like, you know, the masks made a lot of sense, and then kind of got, not old, but, you know, maybe they're old now because, you know, we're all wearing them, but
yeah.
But yeah, so that would be what I would skip.
I mean, I just love anything that sounds like very 60s, garagey, psychedelic, so I don't know. For me, like the song that really like makes me get up and move is like the title track. So that was just me though. I just felt
I love that.
His vocals are just so playful and like it's just so fun, and the energy is just like gets me going.
Shall we hop into the second album? I think so. It is from the same year, Modest Mouse is The Moon in Antarctica. Billy, you want to hop in and tell us some of your memories of this one?
I found it a little hard to go back to this one because...
Yeah, same.
Same.
For me, I was really emotionally attached to this record. I was kind of a huge fan of Modest Mouse. Lonesome Crowded West was like a really important record to me. And I remember when they signed to a major label, it was kind of like, you know, Modest Mouse is selling out. And it's kind of like heartbroken. But, you know, they made the record. And I remember the record kind of coming out around, I feel like around the time, again, like Kid A. And I'm not exactly sure, but it felt like around that time. And it was definitely around the time when it was like the Bush reelection zone. And I was like a senior in college. And I remember I'd done Ecstasy for the first time with a friend in college, and we sat and listened to Kid A and Moon in Antarctica back to back, like all the way through. And I remember he filmed it, and I never want to see that. I never want to see what I was saying, but because like it's cringe to the, but yeah, but I do remember all the feelings I had, and the record is just like, it's really crazy because it sort of tied together those two things that I loved, which was like American indie of like sort of like Pavement and then sort of like the space and sort of experimentation of Radiohead. And it was kind of like, you know, it was like it ground, it's like met in the middle of those two, of Pavement as the ground and Radiohead was space. Like Modest Mouse kind of bridged that gap and still had some of the elements of like Talking Heads that I was really obsessed with, and a little bit more rhythmic, dancey, kind of like Clinic in a sense, where some of it was like groovy, compared to a lot of the other sort of like brooding indie rock that was sort of coming out.
Right.
And I just remember being so inspired by the record and going to see a few of the shows and, you know, never knowing if Isaac Rock was going to be like, you know, blacked out or if he was going to play a good show, or there was just something kind of like punk and exciting about them at the time. And I feel like they were uncomfortable with like a major label, but just kind of easing into that stuff, which, you know, later really worked out for them globally, with their next record. But yeah, for me, that was just, that was a big record at that age. I was 20 or 21 years old. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I had a moment in college where I really was listening to a lot of emo and screamo stuff, and not that I would necessarily put Modest Mouse in this category, but I feel like some of these songs were maybe adjacent to that whole thing. So I was going to see Saves the Day and Taking Back Sunday and whoever else, Brand New, who Modest Mouse toured with at one point fairly recently. But for some reason, this album wasn't as much on my radar as maybe it should have been. And embarrassingly, I didn't really kind of have a moment with them until they had those big radio blog hits, you know? So I kind of went backwards a little bit. So I don't have as much of a personal relationship with this release. That's my two cents on that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people did that. Actually, a person who lives in my building, I was talking about the record with today, he said the same thing. He had heard Float On and kind of worked his way backwards and kind of fell in love with the record after. Yeah, I was lucky enough to have gotten turned on to them earlier. And it was like, you know, like with my learner's permit, listening to like Lonesome Crowded West and like having that freedom and like the angst of Isaac Brock and, you know, the screaming and then the soft singing and then the quiet, loud Pixies thing was just, it just really spoke to angsty, emotional young Billy Jones.
Yeah. I mean, I am a typical late bloomer. That's like my whole life. I'm a late bloomer, but like, yeah, I didn't actually get into Modest Mouse till later. I just remember being at a concert, and I mean, actually, I think like I was I was friends with their agent, and I met another friend who's like a close friend now at a show. I think we were like at Terminal 5 or something. I forget who we were watching, and they were like, "Did I meet you at a Modest Mouse show like in the 90s?" And I was like, "I wish."
I wish
I was that cool. I love that you think that.
yeah, and it was actually like, it was definitely this like snobby, like, oh, you either like liked Modest Mouse or you didn't, you know. That was like my kind of my like the era, which is so silly, but at the time, but it was kind of like a thing. And like I remember going to see them, and the Shins opened up for them, and I guess Isaac had kind of discovered them as he like kind of got a weird little gig doing A&R for Sub Pop, and that was like the introduction of the Shins to me, is like seeing them open for Modest Mouse at Black Cat in Washington DC, which is really wild. And you know, after what they did kind of after that.
Yeah, I don't know, like, yeah, I have like memories of really going to see them when the Float On kind of wave came on, just like live, and being like at Webster Hall and just being surrounded by like frat dudes. And I actually,
yeah, the fan base changed, I'm sure.
The fan base changed and I didn't like it. And
I mean, the indie, even when they were in more indie, it was just indie frat bros. It was just the same kind of, it's just the worst. They're worse than actual frat guys. No. But yeah, no, I know. I remember going to see them. It was actually one of those cool kind of summer tours, but it was, for me, it was like the last straw of seeing them. But it was like, I think it was, and we can Google this together, but it was like Cake, Modest Mouse, and then I want to say Flaming Lips, but I know that's not true. There was like another band, but it was like, yeah, it was like this kind of interesting outdoor summer traveling tour. And that, yeah, the crowd that you mentioned was quite similar.
Yeah. And but then I have like a memory of seeing them like at United Palace, and that was like when Johnny Marr was playing with them, and I was like backstage, and I just remember like thinking like, Isaac Brock and Johnny Marr are both short guys. And they're the same height.
And you wrote about it.
I did write about that.
That's so strange. It's like I totally forgot that Johnny Marr was in Modest Mouse, and I like this is like so you know I for some reason I wrote off the Smiths for my entire life, and I would hear them, but I never really heard them. And then I remember, embarrassingly enough, last year or like 2 years ago, because this year doesn't count, or 1 year, I don't even know, but maybe 2 years. Does this year count? I don't know. But something happened where the Smiths clicked for me, like at age 40 or 39 or whatever I am then. And I spent the entire summer, like a 15-year-old, listening to the Smiths. Like I couldn't hear anything else. Like nothing else was as good as the Smiths. So now it's kind of like, I wish I had gotten a chance to see Johnny Marr, because his guitar is incredible, and the Smiths like play with Modest Mouse. Like I have no, yeah. I don't even know what it would sound like to hear him play on some of those earlier songs that I know and love.
Johnny Marr is definitely like a transcendent experience. Even when he was doing like the stuff with like the Healers and stuff, like I remember just going to see him and just being like, this guy can literally chew bubble gum and play guitar exactly. at the same time.
Yeah, I saw Johnny Marr, and we've talked about it on the podcast, so I won't revisit it for too long, but with the Cribs when he was doing that stint with them. And that was the night I met him and kind of freaked out. And then he did he released a book a couple years ago, and he had an event at Gramercy Theater, which is that venue, whatever. Anyway, and I got to meet him again, and that time I didn't fall down and start crying, so that was good. Yeah,
I'm ready to fall down crying, Johnny, so. I'm prepared.
But yeah, going back to this Modest Mouse release, I think probably my favorite would be Third Planet, and my skip would be, well, I picked two actually. One was Tiny Cities Made of Ashes. I just kind of felt like a Talking Heads vibe that I actually was not into. And also The Stars Are Projectors, just because that song is like 9 minutes long, and after about 4 or 5 minutes, I was kind of over it, to be honest. But one more thing I wanted to mention about Modest Mouse from this era is that they played Siren Festival in 2002. And I wish I paid more attention, because my mind was solely focused on Sleater-Kinney, Yeah Yeah Yeahs, The Donnas, Pretty Girls Make Graves, like all my girl bands. And like when Modest Mouse came on, I was probably like having a beer and paying zero attention, honestly. And I'm a little embarrassed, but yeah.
Dude, I like didn't realize they were on that bill. Like I saw that in your notes, and I was like, wait, what? They were? I mean, I think that was the same year. Was that the same year La Sabe Fav also played?
Yes.
I feel like I was very focused on like watching them and just the, you know, the wild thing that is Tim Harrington to watch live. Yeah. But, you know, and then also like I think that was the first time I had seen the Shins as well. So I mean, that was kind of like a crazy year for Siren Festival. But,
yeah.
You know, it's funny that you say Tiny Cities Made of Ashes, because like I feel like that was like my favorite track from this, although it was a really hard album to get through, just because one, it's like an hour long and there's like a billion songs on it. But like that one I thought was pretty cool, because like, it, you know, there's just like a really cool bass line, I thought. And, you know, I like even when he gets like kind of screamy, it's like still melodic and stuff. And there's nice energy to it. I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like that was a song that I guess had the most sort of like radio play. If there was one.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It definitely sticks out more so than others, and has kind of like, you know, that was not that they had anything to do with it, but that was like, there was some sort of in the ether of the subconscious, the cultural subconscious, if you will, that dance punk kind of post punk dance thing was like beginning to happen with like the Rapture and stuff like that. And that song could have fallen on like a mixtape of those things.
But, you know, I was kind of like more like as far as like skipping a track, trying to decide between like wild packs of family dogs and I came as a rat. I don't know. Just something about them just didn't resonate with me.
Yeah. I feel like I would skip wild pack of family dogs too.
Yeah.
Did
you have like a favorite from the album? Or?
Yeah, I think Third Planet, just because it opens up and it's really pretty and so iconic. And it just, for someone who knows and loves the record, it's like you're taking off or going into it. And so that would be my favorite track on the record. Tiny Cities Made of Ashes is also, and Stars Are Projectors. But there's actually a song, and I think it's basically on the Spotify now, but it came out on the Japanese release of the import. Remember, imports were so cool. They have like a song that
no one
knows. But the import had the song called Night on the Sun. And it's, I think it just wouldn't fit on a CD. Like you said, it was so long, and it's like a 10 or 11 minute song. And so I think they did like a 12 inch, or I don't even know if they were producing 12 inches, or just like an EP or a single for just that. But it's basically a part of the record, and it feels like the record, and it's on the record. And I was really into like long jams and space. And so I feel like that song was, I thought, the closest sort of bridge between the Lonesome Crowded West and that record. So although it's not on the record, it is one of my favorite songs on the record.
Uh-huh. Got it. Adjacent.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, like, you know, I read that Isaac Brock wasn't like happy with this album, like the mix of it or like the order of tracks, and like he really wanted to like reissue it and like redo some of the mixes.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did he ever do that? Was there ever like a reissue?
There was like a couple.
Isaac's mix.
Like, 2004, I think there was like a reissue, and then like I think like in 2010 for like the 10 year anniversary they did another reissue, but then I think it ended up like going back to like the original like tracks. So it was like a very back and forth with that stuff.
Yeah, apparently he was in a dark place during the recording of that. I just, you know, stumbled up. Like, he broke his jaw in a bar fight.
Ooh.
During that recording, because they were doing it in Chicago with this guy, Brian Dick. And so I guess he was going out at night and stuff. And he ruffled people's feathers. I remember hearing a lot about that, even like in the local scene and stuff. He could, you know, he's kind of a dick, but I don't think his heart was in the right place. But I think he just kind of lost control sometimes. But yeah, I think that was a maybe. You know, but to me, the record, yeah, I think the record's perfect. So that's, yeah, I probably should have picked something where I really wouldn't skip any track on this record either. But I'd skip all the records that came after. But
yeah, right.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh my gosh. Yes. What a pleasure and an honor to see you, see you both again. Stars from my past. Yes, you guys have very, thank you for all of your support through the years and what you guys do.
Yeah, thank you. You know, also like just congratulations on everything you've achieved throughout the years. I think it's like so admirable, and like and then to achieve that but still be like cool, awesome, like, you know, friendly guy. Like, I think that's like, you know, a rare gem there. You know?
Yes. Well, my mother raised me well. Mom, if you're listening, thanks for clicking on the Instagram story link. even though I had to show you how.
I love it.
Keep us updated on when the shop opens. Yeah.
Well, I'll come back and I'll plug that, and we'll do some more records that I don't skip any songs on.
Perfect.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Billy, for joining us on another episode of Mixtape Memories, and we will catch you next time. Bye.
Bye.